pictures. But he just isn't very smart. And Juliet isn't too strong in that department either. I mean, a potion to almost kill you? She drinks a potion to almost kill you? Who would drink a potion to almost kill you? Then Romeo goes ahead and drinks a potion that will kill you because he can't figure out that she's only had a potion that almost kills you? And then Juliet, who at least is smart enough to figure out that Romeo really is dead, makes sure that she uses a knife this time, which is not almost going to kill you, but really will kill you? Doesn't this sound like something that two people who can't find their way around the block would get themselves into? Of course it does. Mrs. Baker couldn't see this problem at all, because she's a teacher, and no teacher ever does. "Didn't you find it tragic and beautiful and lovely?" she asked me when I told her I'd finished it. "See?" "Not really," I said.
"What did you find it, then?"
"Stupid."
There we have an opinion that overturns 375 years of critical appreciation. Is there a particular reason that you find it stupid?
Because they never would have done what they did.
Fall in love?
All the stuff at the end.
The poison in the knife, she said.
Yes, they never would have done that.
Mrs. Baker considered this for a moment.
What would they have done?
Gone to Mantua together? And their parents?
Ignored them!
I'm not sure that life is quite as simple as that. These are star-crossed lovers. Their fate is not in their own hands. They have to do what has already been decided for them. That's why it's so tragic and beautiful and lovely.
You see? Tragic and beautiful and lovely again? Why not just stupid and dumb?
Mira Lee thought it was wonderful that I was reading Romeo and Juliet, since, having been inspired by the Long Island Shakespeare Company's holiday extravaganza, she was reading it too.
Don't you think it's romantic, Holling?
I guess so.
And you're reading it just before Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
The most romantic day of the year. Don't you love the balcony scene?
She clasped her hands and held them beneath her chin.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo. Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Merrily, let's go somewhere together for Valentine's Day. I turned around to look behind me, because someone else must have said what just popped out of my mouth.
What?
Said Merrily.
I was still trying to figure out how that popped out. I think it must have been because of Mrs. Baker and her Shakespeare is expressing something about what it means to be a human being, and the tragic and beautiful and lovely routine.
It all had gotten into the air and mixed together, and the first thing you know, after you start breathing that stuff, you say things like what I said to Mira Lee. But what could I do now? So I said it again. Let's go somewhere together for Valentine's Day.
She put her hand on her hip and thought for a moment. Then,
no,
she said. This, in case you're missing it, is the tragic part.
Why not? I said.
Because you called me a blind mole, and then you acted like a jerk about your father winning the Baker's Sporting Emporium contract.
That was 3 months ago, and I did not act like a jerk.
You still called me a blind mole and hoped, let me see if I can get this right, you hoped that an unwholesome dew from a wicked fen would drop on me?
It was actually a wicked dew from an unwholesome fen, but I'm a lot smarter than Romeo, and I know when to shut up. Now here comes the lovely part.
Merrily, I said, there lies more peril in thine eye than 20 of their swords. Look thou but sweet.
20 of whose swords?
It's Shakespeare, I said.
It doesn't have to make sense. They just have to be words more beautiful than have ever yet been written.
So mole and blind are two words more beautiful than have ever yet been written?
Had I it written, I would tear the word.
Merrily smiled.
All right, she said. I'll go.
I told you it was the lovely part.
Even though I still can't figure out how those words popped out of my mouth. That night, I sat through supper trying to decide where I could take Mara Lee on an allowance that I had to string together for 3 weeks just to get some cream puffs. There was a moment, this will tell you how desperate I was, when I thought I might ask Mr. Goldman about another play. But it might be Romeo and Juliet, and that would mean more tights. And not for the whole wide world was I going to wear tights again. So I asked my mother,
where could I take someone with $3.78?
The supper table quieted. Well, she said, I suppose for an ice cream cone.
It's February, I said.
Then maybe to Woolworth's for a hamburger and a Coke.
Woolworth's?
She shrugged. And then to a movie afterward. My mother was not powerful at arithmetic.
Who are you taking?
Asked my father. Merrily.
Merrily who?
Merrily Kowalski.
Merrily Kowalski, the daughter of Paul Kowalski of Kowalski and Associates?
I guess, I said. He laughed.
You'd better hurry.
Why hurry?
If Hood Hood and Associates get the junior high school contract, and we intend to, then Kowalski and Associates may very well be no more. He laughed again.
Take her to Woolworth's, said my sister.
Really?
Really.
Then she'll know you're a cheapskate and dump you after the first date.
If you think saving someone's life is all it's cracked up to be, and that the savee should swear eternal loyalty and gratitude to the saver, you don't know the part about how the savee, if she has a picture of her buttocks published in the Hometown Chronicle, has no further obligations to the saver. If my father was sounding more arrogant than usual, it's because he had brought home a scale model of his design for the new junior high school, and he figured it was a winner. And looking at it, sitting on the dining room sideboard, where all the silver had been pushed to the edges to make room for it, I thought he might be right. No pillars, he pointed out, no brickwork, no symmetrical layout. Everything was to be new and modern, so there were curved corners and curved walls. The roof was a string of domes all made out of glass. They arched over the main lobby, the gym, and clusters of science and art classrooms. When I pointed out that the building wasn't square, he pointed out that this was 1968, after all, and times were changing. Architecture should change, too. He pushed back his chair, walked over to the model, and took off its top half.
Look at this interior, he said. Open hallways that rise 3 stories to the domes. Every classroom looks out into sunlit space. No one's ever come up with that concept for a junior high school before.
Like I told you, it was a winner. But it didn't help me plan a $3.78 evening for Valentine's Day with Merrill Lee. And after supper, while my sister washed and I dried, she was even more helpful than she had been before. What are you going to give Merrill Lee before you go out on your date? She asked. It's not a date, so why should I give her something before we go out? Of course it's a date. You have to give her something, like flowers or candy. Don't you know anything? It's Valentine's Day. I have $3.78. Then buy a rose. Have the florist put a ribbon on it or something. Merrill Lee will figure out you're a cheapskate soon enough anyway.
I'm not a cheapskate. I just don't have any money.
My sister shrugged. It's the same thing, she said. The next day I asked Danny where he would take someone if he were going somewhere for Valentine's Day.
I am going somewhere for Valentine's Day, he said.
You are?
I'm going out with my tea.
You are? I said again. He nodded. Where are you going?
To Milleridge Inn.
Milleridge Inn?
You have to know that this is the most expensive place to eat you can go to on the eastern seaboard. And afterward, my dad is going to drive us to see Camelot.
He is?
Danny nodded again. Just swell, I said.
You know how it's sometimes possible to hate your best friend's guts? I figured by the time Danny was done, he'd spend $17 or $18, and he'd probably buy her a rose, too.
Toads, beetles, bats.
The Wednesday before Valentine's Day, for the cheapskate, Mrs. Baker and I read aloud the last 2 acts of Romeo and Juliet. It was okay, but Romeo still was a jerk.
Come, bitter conduct, come, unsavory guide. Thou desperate pilot, now at once run on the dashing rocks, thy seasick weary bark.
Sure, if I was about to die for love, I think I could come up with something better than that. But I guess the rest was all right, down in the tombs with torches and swords and stuff. Shakespeare needed to get more of that in. By the time we were done, Mrs. Baker was almost in tears. It was all so tragic and beautiful and lovely. You need to see this on stage, Mr. Hood Hood. It's playing at the Festival Theater on Valentine's Day. Go see it. Now, aren't you glad I didn't ask Mr. Goldman about another play? I told you the next one would be Romeo and Juliet.
In tights.
This is called foresight, and it probably saved me from more white feathers on my butt. I'm already taking Marilee someplace on Valentine's Day, I told Mrs. Baker.
Are you? Where are you taking her?
Some place that costs less than what's left over from $3.78 after you buy a rose with a ribbon on it.
That limits you somewhat.
My sister says that Marilee will think I'm a cheapskate.
It's not how much you spend on a lady, said Mrs. Baker. It's how much you give her of yourself.
Like Romeo.
She nodded. Like Romeo.
He didn't end up too well, I pointed out.
No, she said. But Juliet never asked for anything but him.
So, is that what Shakespeare wanted to express about being a human being?
That, said Mrs. Baker, may well be a question for your essay examination on Romeo and Juliet. Next Wednesday we'll review, and you'll write it the week after that.
No.
No more 150 question tests. You are ready to do more than that.
I guess that was good news. On Valentine's Day, Mr. Guareschi announced over the PA that Mrs. Biggio had baked Valentine's Day cupcakes for the junior high, and each class should send down a representative to pick up the class's allotted number of cupcakes at 1 o'clock. I know this doesn't sound like a big deal, but let me tell you, Mrs. Biggio can bake cupcakes. You never want to turn down a Mrs. Biggio cupcake, even if it is all pastel pink with little hearts in the frosting.
We thought about the cupcakes all day.
We even smelled them baking, their beautiful and lovely cakey aroma wafting down the halls. When the clock clicked to 1:05, Danny gently reminded Mrs. Baker about the cupcakes. He said that he hoped that she hadn't forgotten them.
Mr. Hupfer, has it been your experience that I have ever forgotten anything? Asked Mrs. Baker.
Danny had to admit that she never forgot anything. Mrs. Baker looked at her watch.
I'm sure that Mrs. Biggio will have made a sufficient number.
She went back to reading aloud a tragic love poem by Alfred, Lord Tennyson, who, I guess, couldn't figure out how to punctuate his own name. 1:14. Still waiting for Mrs. Baker to send down a representative for the cupcakes. Up above the asbestos ceiling tiles, Caliban and Sycorax are stirring, probably since the smell of pink icing is now filling the hallways.
1:17.
Still waiting. The bulging asbestos ceiling tiles are vibrating.
1:18.
Mrs. Baker finally sends me down to Mrs. Biggio. Danny tells me to hurry since he is always hungry.
1:18 and a half. I run in the hallways.
Mrs. Biggio was waiting for me with the last tray of Valentine's Day cupcakes. She slid them along the kitchen table toward me and then slid an envelope across as well.
Open it, she said. You'll want it for tonight.
I opened it. Inside were 2 tickets for Romeo and Juliet at the Festival Theater.
Mrs. Biggio, I said.
They're season tickets, and I won't be using them tonight, so they'll just go to waste if you don't take them. And the gossip I've picked up is that you can use them, unless you want to be known as a cheapskate.
Thank you, I said. I can use them.
That night, Mr. Kowalski drove Marilee and me to the Festival Theater to see a production of Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare for Valentine's Day. We sat in 2 seats in the center of the 3rd row. Marilee held the red rose with a ribbon I had bought her. Mr. Goldman played Friar Lawrence and winked at me once from the stage. The poisoning and stabbing scene was okay, but I still think that Romeo is a jerk. They needed the ghost of Banquo up there to tell them to lay off the stabbing. Or maybe Caliban. But Marilee loved it all. She was sobbing by the time it was over.
Wasn't it beautiful? She said as the lights came up.
So tragic, I said.
That's just the word, she said.
We walked through the evening light to Woolworth's, where we sat at the lunch counter and I ordered 2 Cokes.
Let me tell you, it was just swell.
We did the balcony scene together as nearly as we could, until a guy behind the counter began to look like he wanted us gone. So we ordered 2 more Cokes to make him happy. I still had $1.37 left, and didn't want Marilee to think I was a cheapskate.
Are you going to play a part in another Shakespeare play? Marilee asked.
I thought of her sobbing at the end of Romeo and Juliet.
Of course, I said. That wasn't even a Presbyterian lie. It was a flat-out lie.
But after doing the balcony scene with Mara Lee, I wasn't going to tell her what a jerk Romeo was and how the only way I was going back onto the festival theater stage was... Well, there wasn't any way. Mara Lee looked at her watch. My father will be here soon, she said. I hope he remembers. I sipped my Coke. I hoped he forgot. All he does is work on the model for the new junior high school. He goes over and over it. He moves a pillar here, then another one there.
It's not classical enough,
he says.
It needs to look like the Capitol building. Classical.
When Mara Lee imitated her father, her eyes got large and her hands went up and she spoke low. She should be on the festival theater stage.
Classical, 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 said Mara Lee. There's hardly another word that comes out of his mouth.
My dad doesn't have any pillars, I said. He's got his model all modern.
Modern?
I nodded. No pillars, no straight walls, so much glass that they'll need 3 Mr. Van Leary's to keep it all clean. That kind of modern. I asked the guy behind the counter for his pencil. He hesitated a second, since I guess he wasn't so sure about us. But he handed it over and made me promise to give it back. And then I drew the glass domes over the main lobby and gym and the science and art classrooms, and the curved corners and walls and the clusters of classrooms looking out into sunlit space, all over my white paper placemat.
No one's ever come up with that concept for a junior high school before, I said.
Mara Lee stared at my drawing, then went back to sipping her Coke. Her hair is auburn. Did I tell you that? In the lights of Woolworth's, it shimmered. Mr. Kowalski did remember to come. We finished our Cokes, and I handed back the pencil to the guy behind the counter, and Mara Lee took my placemat as a souvenir, and we walked to the car, hand in hand. Mr. Kowalski dropped me off at my house, and I wasn't sure, sitting in the back seat, how to say goodbye to Mara Lee, but she saved the day.
"'Tis almost morning," she said. "I would have thee gone."
"Sleep, dwell upon thine eyes," I said. I didn't have to look at Mr. Kowalski to know that his eyes were rolling in his head. So that was Valentine's Day. The following week, the school board met to decide on the model for the new junior high school, which was probably why Mr. Kowalski had been spending all his time muttering,
"Classical, classical, classical."
The meeting was to be at 4 o'clock in the high school administration building. Mr. Kowalski would present his plan and model, and then my father would present his plan and model, and then the school board would meet in private session to decide whether Kowalski and Associates or Hoodhood and Associates would be the architect for the new junior high school. I know all of this because my father was making me come. It was time I started to learn the business, he said. I needed to see firsthand how competitive bidding worked. I needed to experience architectural presentations. I needed to see architecture as the blood sport that it truly was. Which makes architecture sound like a profession that Macbeth could have done pretty well in. The meeting was in the public conference room, and when I got there after school, the school board members were all sitting at the head table, studying the folders with the architectural bids. Mr. Kowalski and my father were sitting at 2 of the high school desks, which made the whole thing seem a little weirder than it needed to be. In front of them was a long table with 2 models for the new junior high school, each one covered with a white sheet, like they were some sort of national secret. I sat behind my father. There was a whole lot of preliminary agenda stuff, and old business, and procedural decisions, and all that. My father sat through it coolly, occasionally looking at his watch or squaring the edges of his presentation notes. Mr. Kowalski was more nervous. I'm not sure that his cigarette was out of his mouth for more than 3 seconds at a time.
Mr. Kowalski, we're ready for your presentation now, said Mr. Bradbrook, who was the chairman of the school board.
He sat at the head of the table, sort of like God would sit if God wore a suit. He was smoking too, but he wasn't working at it as hard as Mr. Kowalski was.
You have 8 minutes, he said.
Mr. Kowalski picked up his presentation notes and angled out of his seat. He went up to the table with the models and stood there for a moment. Then he turned and looked at, no, not my father, at me.
Really?
My father looked at him. Then he turned and looked at me like I should know what was going on. But I didn't. I just shrugged.
7 minutes, said Mr. Bradbrook.
Mr. Kowalski cleared his throat twice. He looked at his design papers. He cleared his throat again. Then he looked back at me once more and began.
Gentlemen, he said, though this is irregular, I have made some significant design changes for the interior of the new junior high since my original submission. In fact, the entire concept has changed markedly. So the plans that you studied for this afternoon's presentation have also changed. I have copies of the new interior plans and ask the board's patience as I show you the concept. This may take slightly longer than the allotted time, but I'm sure that the Chamber of Commerce businessman of 1967 won't begrudge Kowalski and Associates a few extra minutes in order to clarify the proposal and to promote the general business atmosphere of the town.
This is irregular, said Mr. Bradbrook. Has the new concept affected the cost estimates?
Not significantly, said Mr. Kowalski.
Mr. Bradbrook considered.
Well, he said, if Mr. Hood-Hood will agree, then I see nothing wrong with your presentation going slightly longer. Mr. Hood-Hood?
What could the Chamber of Commerce businessman of 1967 do? He shrugged and nodded. But the back of his neck grew as red as boiling sin, and I knew he did begrudge the extra time. He begrudged it a whole lot. Mr. Kowalski pulled off the sheet from his model of the new junior high school. He cleared his throat again.
As you can see, gentlemen, said Mr. Kowalski, the design is quite classical in the best traditions of our national architecture. For a time when our children desperately need to be reminded of our great American traditions.
And it was. It looked like the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Wide steps swooped up past a line of pillars and up to the central doors. Above that rose a steep dome with thin windows cut all around it. On either side of the dome, the buildings spread graceful wings, all with thin windows again. And behind the long gymnasium formed the tail, whose rows of bright windows faced south and north to let in as much light as any gymnasium could ever have.
But we live in 1968, gentlemen,
Mr. Kowalski said.
Just as our children need to be reminded of our great traditions, so too do they need to enjoy the advantages of contemporary technology. I think you'll find the new interior design both modern and innovative, a perfect blend of where we have been and where we are going as a nation.
He handed out copies of the plans for the new design to all the school board members, keeping his back to my father and me the whole time. Then he took us all through the new interior. Slowly. No pillars, no straight walls. The roof, a series of glass plates above the science and art rooms. The central dome, 3 stories high over the main lobby, and clusters of classrooms all looking out into the sunlit space. All as modern as could be.
I don't believe that anyone has ever come up with this blended concept for a junior high school before,
said Mr. Kowalski. Then he sat back down. He did not look over at us. Instead, he lit another cigarette and began pulling at it. He shuffled all of his papers into a folder. The school board was astounded. 3 of them applauded. Not Mr. Bradbrook, since God doesn't applaud. My father turned and looked at me again. His face was very red, and I could tell he was fighting for some kind of control.
Holling, there's something you should have told me, isn't there? He whispered slowly.
I looked at him.
Do you think this is a game? This is the future of Hood-Hood and Associates. Everything rides on this, my future and your future. So what did you do?
He used the kind of voice that, in my family, means that a voice a whole lot louder is about to come along in a minute or two, so you'd better start preparing. But let me tell you, I didn't really care all that much about what he would say or how loudly he would say it. I really didn't. Because suddenly, I knew something a whole lot worse. Romeo was a genius compared to me. I hadn't seen at all what Mary Lee was doing on Valentine's Day, while we were sipping Cokes at the lunch counter at Woolworth's. I hadn't realized how easily she had gotten what she wanted from me, my father's design for the new junior high. Run me on the dashing rocks and hand me a vial of poison. I'm such a jerk, I'd probably drink it. I'm a bigger jerk even than Mickey Mantle. I got up before I began to bawl like a first grader.
Holling,
warned my father, a slightly louder, slow whisper. I left the conference room. My red father never did tell me what he did for his presentation. Probably it began with him demanding to see Mr. Kowalski's plans, and then suggesting that he took these from Hoodhood and Associates, not saying it outright, but just suggesting it like he knew it was the truth but wouldn't say it. And then arguing that Mr. Kowalski should withdraw his proposal because it wasn't the same one he had submitted, and that's not how honest businessmen worked. It would have been something like that, with him getting redder and redder all the time. I bet if you were watching it, you sure would have seen that architecture is a blood sport, and Macbeth couldn't have played it any bloodier than my father. February is a can't-decide-what-it-wants-to-be month on Long Island. What's left of any snow is melted into brown slush and runs in dirty ridges alongside the street gutters. The grass is dank and dark. Everything is damp, as if the whole island had been dipped under dark water and is only starting to dry out. Mornings are always gray and cold. That's what it was like between Marilee and me the next day at school. Slushy, damp, dirty, dark, gray, and cold. We didn't look at each other. At lunch, we ate about as far away from each other as we could, and she went outside early, even though Marilee hardly ever went outside. She didn't come to chorus, so I sang the soprano part for Miss Violet of the Very Spiky Heels, alone at our stand. When Mrs. Baker asked if I'd like to partner with Marilee on the sentence diagramming exercise in the afternoon, I told her I'd rather do it with Doug Swiatek. On Friday, things were still slushy, damp, dirty, dark, and cold. Marilee wore sunglasses to school, even though it was gray like always. When Mrs. Baker asked her to remove them for class, she said that her doctor had asked her to keep them on, that she was supposed to keep them on for, maybe, the rest of the school year. I was the only one in class who didn't laugh at that. I looked out the window. For the next Wednesday, I wrote an essay for Mrs. Baker about what Shakespeare wanted to express about being a human being in Romeo and Juliet. Here is the first sentence in my essay. What Shakespeare wanted to express about being a human being in Romeo and Juliet is that you better be careful who you trust. Here is the last sentence. If Romeo had never met Juliet, he would have been all right. But because he was star-crossed, he did meet her. And because she came up with all sorts of plans that she didn't bother telling him about, he ended up taking poison and dying, which is an important lesson for us to learn in life. I had Marilee to thank for this, you know? If she hadn't done what she did, I never would have figured out what Shakespeare was trying to express in Romeo and Juliet about what it means to be a human being. When I handed the essay in, Mrs. Baker read it through, twice.
So, she said slowly, do you think Juliet was right to stab herself at the end of the play?
Yes, I said.
I see, she said, and she put the essay in a manila folder and left it on top of her desk. But unlike Juliet, Marilee didn't stab herself. In fact, that afternoon she was waiting for me outside the gates of Camillo Junior High, standing beside a ridge of crusted snow that she had stamped down flat.
It wasn't my fault, she said. Aren't you supposed to be at St. Adalbert's?
I just showed him your drawing because it was so good. I didn't know he would use the same design.
Sure, Marilee.
It's true, she said.
All right, it's true. Whatever you say, Marilee. You told him everything about my father's design, everything. And then a few days later, he draws up new plans so that the inside of his school is just like the inside of my father's school. You had nothing to do with it.
I didn't say I had nothing to do with it, said Marilee. I said I didn't know he would use the same design.
I'd keep the dark glasses on, Marilee. It's easier to lie to someone if they can't see your eyes. A long moment went by. Then Marilee took off the glasses and threw them past my head. I think she was trying to throw them at my head.
Then she turned and walked away, but not before I saw why she'd been wearing them. I picked up the glasses and put them in my pocket. That night, I saw those glasses flying past my head again and again and again. And I saw Marilee's red eyes again and again and again. Marilee wasn't in school the next day. I kept looking over at her empty desk. At lunch recess, I wrote a new Romeo and Juliet essay in the library. Here is the first sentence of the essay. What Shakespeare wanted to express about being a human being in Romeo and Juliet is that it's hard to care about two things at the same time, like caring about the Montague family and caring about Juliet too. Here's the last sentence. If Romeo had never met Juliet, maybe they both would have still been alive. But what would they have been alive for is the question that Shakespeare wants us to answer. I handed the essay in to Mrs. Baker at the end of the day. She read it through twice. Then she took my old essay out of the manila folder, which was still on top of her desk, and put in the new essay. She dropped the old essay into the trash, put the folder with the new essay into her desk, and then she looked up at me. "So what will you do now?" she said. That night, with 79 cents left over from Valentine's Day and $1 from Monday's allowance, I bought 2 Cokes and a rose with a ribbon. I took them over to Marilee's house and rang the doorbell. Mr. Kowalski answered it.
"You're the Hood Hood boy,"
he said. "Is Marilee home?" I said. He opened the door further and I came in. He hesitated, then,
"Her room is the one at the top of the stairs,"
he said. I went up the stairs, slowly. I felt his eyes on my back, but I didn't want to turn around to let him know that I felt his eyes on my back. I knocked at Marilee's door. "Go away," she said. I knocked again. I heard her chair scrape against the floor and her footsteps stomping across the room. Her door opened. "I told you—" Then she stopped. Her mouth was open. "I thought you might be thirsty," I said. Her mouth was still open. "Are you?" "Am I what?" "Thirsty." She looked at the Cokes in my hand. "Yes," she said. I handed her a bottle and pulled the opener out of my pocket. I love the sound of a brand new bottle of Coke when you pry the lid off and it starts to fizz. Whenever I hear that sound, I think of roses and of sitting together with someone you care about, and of Romeo and Juliet waking up somewhere and saying to each other, "Weren't we jerks?" and then having all that be over. That's what I think of when I hear the sound of a brand new bottle of Coke being opened. On Thursday, before the school board met to decide on its new architect, Kowalski and Associates withdrew its bid for the new junior high school. Hood Hood and Associates was given the contract.
"What chumps,"
said my father.
"They were going to win hands down. What chumps."
He shook his head.
"They're bound to go under now. But if you can't play for keeps, you shouldn't be in the business in the first place. And Kowalski never could play for keeps. And Hood Hood and Associates can."
He rubbed his hands together like Shylock on stage. And that's when something changed. I suddenly wondered if my father was really like Shylock. Not because he loved ducats, but because maybe he had become the person that everyone expected him to become. I wondered if he had ever had a choice, or if he had ever felt trapped, or if he had ever imagined a different life. With this new contract, he was a sure bet for the Chamber of Commerce businessman of 1968. It's probably what everyone expected. For the first time, I wondered if it was what he wanted, or if there was a time when he might have wanted something else. Or if I wanted something else. Or if we were both only fortune's fools, like Romeo. Marilee and I were partners on Friday for sentence diagramming. We ate together at lunch, and we decided to be partners for Mr. Petrelli's next geography assignment, which was on the California Gold Rush and you.
"Make it relevant,"
said Mr. Petrelli. We sang together in chorus for Miss Violet of the Very Spiky Heels, and when it came time at the end of the day to clean the board, we did that together too.
And that's why we were at the board together when Mr. Guareschi came into the classroom to give Mrs. Baker a yellow telegram. A telegram that she took out of the envelope, then read, then dropped onto the floor as she rushed out, leaving Mr. Guareschi standing in front of the class without any idea what to do. When we picked up the telegram to put on her desk, Marilee and I could hardly not read it ourselves, or at least the words that mattered. Downed helicopter transport. Stop. Kaysan. Stop. Lieutenant T. Baker, missing in action. Stop. March. The news from Kaysan that Walter Cronkite reported each night kept getting grimmer. The 5,000 Marines there were cut off and could get supplies only by air, even though any helicopter that flew over took a lot of enemy fire from the 20,000 surrounding Viet Cong troops. Meanwhile, the Marines were dug into bunkers, covered with 3 feet of earth to protect them from the mortar shells that the Viet Cong were lobbing into the camp. About 500 mortar shells a day. And when they weren't lobbing shells, the Viet Cong were digging tunnels that they could use to put explosives beneath the Marines. Some reports said that the tunnels were only 100 yards away from the barbed wire around the Kaysan base. The Marines had started to use stethoscopes and divining rods to see if they could find them. You know things are bad when the United States Marine Corps is using stethoscopes and divining rods. Still, the White House announced that the enemy offensive was running out of steam, that casualties at Kaysan were light, that we would never give up the Marine base there. We watched Walter Cronkite together every night after supper now, even my sister. We were all quiet, and not just because my father would have hollered if anyone had interrupted Walter Cronkite. Sometimes, though, my father himself would shake his head and whisper,
5,000 boys trapped, good Lord, 5,000.
We'd watch the pictures of the Marines in their zigzagging trenches, or deep in their bunkers, holding their hands over their ears inside their helmets because of the thunder of the mortar shells. Then my father would reach for my mother's hand, and they would look at each other. My sister sat rigid, with anger, I guess. She probably wanted to say something like, I told you so, or if President Johnson had listened and gotten us out of there in time, or no one in Washington knows what he's doing. But she didn't. When 500 mortar shells are coming in every day on top of soldiers huddled in holes with their hands over their ears, even a flower child who wanted nothing but world peace could only watch and hope. I also was watching the newscasts and hoping for a sign, any sign, of Lieutenant Tybalt Baker. There never was one. Not in any of the films of the mortars or the trenches or the downed and burning helicopters or the wounded. Walter Cronkite didn't read off the names of the missing in action, so Lieutenant Baker was never mentioned. But I still watched anyway, holding my breath, hoping. Which is what I think the whole town was doing. Which is certainly what Mrs. Baker was doing. But you would never have been able to tell that she was holding her breath at Camillo Junior High. She moved through our classroom as coolly as if Kaysan were just a proper noun in a sentence that needed to be diagrammed. It was early spring, and we were her garden, and she was starting to see the bulbs and seeds that she had planted in us last fall coming up. She raked away our dead leaves, spaded new soil around us, and watered and fertilized. And we grew fast and green, let me tell you, especially my tea, who was now the best sentence diagrammer in the 7th grade, which may not sound like much, but with Mrs. Baker, it was a big deal. During class, it didn't seem as if anything was bothering Mrs. Baker at all, except maybe the 8 bulging asbestos ceiling tiles, which now had about as much bulge as asbestos ceiling tiles can take. They looked like sails in a full breeze. We still didn't know exactly what was making them so heavy. Maybe the rats were hoarding supplies for the summer drought up there. Maybe Sycorax and Caliban were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But whatever it was, no one wanted those tiles to come down with whatever was bulging them out. Not even Danny Hupfer. Which was why on the first Wednesday afternoon in March, while Mrs. Baker was grading and I was at my desk starting in on Julius Caesar, who, let me tell you, was a whole lot smarter than Romeo, even though he ended up pretty badly too. Mr. Van Leary came in with a ladder, 8 new asbestos ceiling tiles, and a heavy mallet. Mrs. Baker looked at him.
A mallet? She said.
He brandished it in the air like Julius Caesar himself.
You don't know how big a rat on the loose can get in 5 months, he said.
Mrs. Baker looked up at the bulging ceiling tiles. I have some idea, she said. Mr. Van Leary set his ladder under one of the bulges. He steadied it and grabbed his mallet tightly in his right hand. He took 3 steps up the ladder, then with his left hand he slowly reached up to one of the bulging tiles. He tapped it a couple of times, and we listened. Nothing. He pushed against it. Nothing. He hit it lightly with the mallet. Still nothing. He came back down the ladder and went over to the corner of the room. He picked up the trash can and came back to the foot of the ladder.
I'll need someone to hold this underneath the tile when I take it off, just in case stuff comes out, he said.
Just in case stuff comes out? Said Mrs. Baker.
That's right,
said Mr. Van Leary. Mrs. Baker looked over at me. Sometimes I think she still hates my guts. So there I was, holding this trash can underneath the 8 bulging asbestos ceiling tiles, and Mr. Van Leary started to push up on one of them with his mallet.
You won't catch the stuff standing over there,
he said to me. I moved a little closer.
Right here,
he said, pointing to the target area. Then he turned and lifted one of the ceiling tiles with his mallet. We listened for the scrambling of 2 large rats. Nothing. So Mr. Van Leary tilted the tile to get it out, and shredded everything came pouring down. Homework announcements, PTA letters home, blue Dittos, bazooka bubblegum wrappers, these were from Danny, chewed up number 2 pencils, red and green and blue and yellow construction paper, napkins from the cafeteria, part of a black sneaker, this is from Doug Swiatek, who had been looking for it for a couple of months, a gnawed picture of me leaping across stage in yellow tights, and scraps of Mara Lee's Mississippi River and You project. It all came down like wet snow.
Hold the trash can under it,
hollered Mr. Van Leary, which is exactly what I was doing, except that the stuff was also falling into my eyes and hair and down the back of my shirt, and I think I must have started screaming because Mrs. Baker came and took the trash can from me. Maybe you should find a different way to collect the refuse, she said to Mr. Van Leary, brushing the rat-chewed stuff off me. By the time Mr. Van Leary brought back a tarp, I had pretty much gotten my shaking under control. He handed me that mallet. What am I supposed to do with this? I asked.
Swing at anything that has yellow teeth, he said.
Oh, I said quietly. I wasn't sure if that was better than having the rat-chewed stuff come down on my head. But even though I started to shake again, I held the mallet over my shoulder ready to strike, which you have to admit is not only brave and courageous and true and blue and worthy of Jim Hawkins himself, but also pretty remarkable considering I still had rat-chewed stuff in my hair and down my back. But we never saw Sycorax or Caliban. Mr. Van Leary replaced the bulging ceiling tiles with 8 new ones, then stepped from the ladder and stood back.
Good as new,
he said. Are you sure? Asked Mrs. Baker. I'm sure, I willed him to say. I'm sure, I'm sure, I'm sure.
I'm sure,
said Mr. Van Leary. Then, said Mrs. Baker to me, you may return to Julius Caesar.
But let me tell you, it's not easy to read a Shakespeare play when you've just been holding a mallet over your shoulder, ready to swing at anything that has yellow teeth, and Mr. Van Leary is still poking at the other tiles to see if they were bulging too, and knowing that any tile could come crashing to the floor along with Sycorax and Caliban, and they would not be happy, let me tell you. I wanted to read Julius Caesar standing on my desk, but that would definitely not have been worthy of Jim Hawkins. When he finally left, Mr. Van Leary told us he'd come check on the new asbestos ceiling tiles tomorrow. Thank you, said Mrs. Baker. Then she went back to her grading. I wondered if she had wanted to stand on her desk, too. Grading, by the way, is also something that makes it hard to read Shakespeare. When your teacher is covering papers with red ink a few desks away from you, and you know that yours is in the stack, and it's probably coming up soon, and that your grasp of non-restrictive clauses might not be all that it should be, it's hard to read anything, even though there was some good stuff in Julius Caesar.
You blocks. You stones. You worse than senseless things. It doesn't have the cut of a Caliban curse, but it's all right. It also didn't help that Mrs. Baker kept wiping at her eyes during her grading. She'd told us that she had a terrible cold, but she hardly needed to tell us. Her eyes were mostly red all the time, and the way she blew her nose could be pretty impressive. Sometimes, while sitting at her desk, she'd just stop doing whatever she was doing and look somewhere far away, like she wasn't even in the classroom anymore. It was a terrible cold, and day after day it kept on and even seemed to be getting worse. Mara Lee said that she was up to half a box of Kleenex per class, which has got to be some kind of world record. So when she announced on Friday that members of the school board were coming to our room to observe and evaluate classroom performance by both students and their teacher, she told us in a soggy voice that drowned at the end. But drowning or not, she kept going.
She was Mrs. Baker.
I will expect you all to be polite to the school board members. I will expect you to be on your very best behavior. I will expect you to show in an appropriate manner what you have been studying this school year. When are they coming? Asked Mara Lee. Before I tell you what Mrs. Baker said, I have something else to tell you, because you won't believe what happened otherwise if I don't. When Julius Caesar is coming into Rome, which is a place where very bad things will happen to him, this soothsayer comes up to him to tell him what's going to happen. And this is what he says to Julius Caesar. Beware the Ides of March. So now I'll tell you what happened after Mara Lee asked, when are they coming? Beware the Ides of March, I said. And Mrs. Baker looked at me and her eyes opened a little bit. And without looking away from me, she said to Mara Lee, a week from today, Miss Kowalski. Which was the Ides of March. You are a soothsayer, Mr. Hood-Hood, said Mrs. Baker. Sometimes I scare even myself, I said. Prophecy is not an unalloyed gift, she said. Be careful how you use it. Which is a teacher strategy to get you to look up the word unalloyed, which I did, and it still didn't make much sense. But what happened later that day was even weirder. In gym, Coach Quattrini announced that he was planning to form the Camillo Junior High School cross-country team. It wouldn't be a regular team since cross-country was a fall sport, but he wanted to start the 7th and 8th graders now so that he could choose a varsity team and have them run over the summer and be ready to begin real competition by September. He expected everybody to try out. Everybody. And to get us started in our training, we would be running 2 miles at tempo. What's at tempo? I asked.
Race pace, he said.
How bad could that be? I said to Danny. Bad, Danny said. Coach Quattrini had us stretch for 3 minutes, then do 4 short sprints down the length of the gym, and then stretch for another 2 minutes. Afterward, he took us outside to the track, where there was a pretty brisk March wind that cut right through my t-shirt. He put us at the starting line, held up his stopwatch, and blew his whistle. Danny was right. Race pace could be bad. I don't know how many times Coach Quattrini used the word faster, but if a word can get worn out and die, this one died like Julius Caesar. He liked to add words to the front of faster. Words like,
a whole lot,
and
can you go any,
and
you better get,
and
dang it.
He also added words after faster, like,
you wimps,
and
you slugs,
and
you dang slugs,
toward the end. It wouldn't have taken much for him to be able to play Caliban on the festival theater stage. Afterward, when we all had our hands on our knees and were trying to suck some air into wherever it wasn't that it needed to get, he reminded us that we all had to try out for the varsity team and promised that tryouts would be a whole lot harder than what we had just done. Toads, beetles, bats. Now here's where the weird part comes. Into my head jumped this sentence. Tryouts will be in a week, on the Ides of March. And as soon as I thought it, Coach Quattrini said,
tryouts will be in a week, and you better be a whole lot faster than this, you dang wimpy slugs.
I wondered if somewhere down deep within me, I really was a soothsayer, even if only the first parts of the sentences were the same. I ran over the weekend, not because I was worried that Coach Quattrini would think I was a dang wimpy slug, but because I was pretty sure that if I didn't, I might have something awful happen to me after running at tryout pace on the Ides of March. I ran 3 miles on Saturday and then 4 miles on Sunday afternoon, even though it was the Sabbath and I deserved some time off. And actually, there was another reason for running over the weekend, an even better reason. My father was mad at my sister, which meant somehow that he was mad at me too, and it was better to be running with my lungs screaming for air than be in a house with my father screaming at me. And let me tell you, it wasn't for anything I'd done. Now that he had the new junior high school contract, my father needed to hire someone else in his office as a receptionist for weekday afternoons and Saturday mornings, and since he didn't want to pay anyone much for this, he decided that my sister should do it, and he would pay her $1.35 an hour and not take out any taxes. He announced this at supper on Friday night. "I can't," said my sister while passing the lima beans and not taking any.
"Of course you can," said my father. "It's about time you started a real job."
"I'm already working," said my sister. We looked at her.
"Who for?"
my father asked. "For Bobby Kennedy," she said.
"For Bobby Kennedy?" said my father.
"Mr. Goldman is letting us use the back of his bakery for campaign headquarters."
"Bobby Kennedy?" said my father again. "Bobby Kennedy is a rich kid from Cape Cod who's never done anything on his own his whole life."
"Bobby Kennedy will end the war, end the discrimination that's splitting our country in two, and end the control of the government by a handful of fat old men." My father, who was not fat and old yet, but who could probably imagine himself that way, started to get a little louder. Not a good sign.
"You might as well go work for that Martin Luther King."
"Maybe I will. He and Bobby Kennedy are the only ones who care that this country is about to explode."
"He's a communist."
"Oh, there's deep political analysis. He's leading a demonstration for striking sanitation workers, so he must be a communist."
"Now you've got it," said my father. "You start work Monday afternoon."
I think you can figure out how the rest of that conversation went, and how my mother and I didn't say much, and how we never did make it to dessert, and why it was a healthy thing for me to be running over the weekend, even though I hadn't done a thing. Still, I was glad that Bobby Kennedy was running for president. It was hard every night hearing President Johnson and all of his generals with medals spread over their chests say how well the war was going and how the enemy was about to give up, and then having CBS News cut to pictures of soldiers who were wading through rice paddies and holding their rifles high above the water, or who were carrying out a buddy whose face was covered with dried blood, or who were huddled in holes and covering their heads as the mortars came over in Quezon. After that, he just wanted someone to say the plain truth, and maybe Bobby Kennedy would be that someone. I was glad he was running for president. And so maybe, after all, I had done something to make my father mad. Just not out loud. At gym on Monday, Coach Quattrini had us run 3 miles, all at tempo. Let me tell you, after running for 2 miles and hearing,
"Can't you go any faster, you dang wimpy slug?"
in your ears for most of it, you start to wonder if life is worth living. You still have 4 more times around the track, and the sky is turning darker, and the air is thinner, and you can't feel the ends of your fingers, and your legs are rock-heavy, and there's something hurting deep down in your guts. Probably your liver is about to explode, but that doesn't matter so much because your lungs are drying out. And that hurts so much that nothing else can get your attention.
"It'll be 5 miles on Friday,"
said Coach Quattrini when we were finished. 5 miles on the Ides of March. On Wednesday afternoon, Mrs. Baker asked how my cross-country preparation was going. "Death, unnecessary end," I said, "will come when it will come." Mrs. Baker smiled. "Do you think that death is coming for you on the cross-country course, Mr. Hood-Hood?" "You know what happened to Julius Caesar on the Ides of March?" I said. "Cross-country tryouts will make that look like opening day at Yankee Stadium." "It's because you run so straight up," she said. "Because I run so straight up?" "And tight. You run so tight. I've watched you. It looks as if you're digging your fingernails into your palms." Which is exactly what I always did. "Are you saying I could run better?" She put down her copy of Julius Caesar. From her lower desk drawer, she took out a pair of bright white sneakers and put them on. "Caesar shall go forth," she said.
Where? I asked. Out to the track. The two of us? Are you embarrassed that I might be faster than you? She asked. I'm not really worried about that, Mrs. Baker, I said. Perhaps you should be, she said. Look what happened to Julius Caesar when he underestimated those around him. So we went out to the track with Mrs. Baker wearing bright white sneakers. Really. Let's start with your stance, she said. Let's lean you forward a little bit so that you can always be moving into the next stride instead of holding yourself back on each stride. Lean this way. I did. Run 50 paces and come back. I did. Again. I did. At tempo, she said. I did. That's fine. One could only wish that you took as easily to diagramming sentences. Now your arm position, and then your head position, and then we'll get to breathing patterns. By the end of the afternoon, Mrs. Baker had remade the way that I ran. I look like a jerk, I said. If Romeo was a runner, he would run like this. What you look like, she said, is Jesse Owens, who won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics running like that. So, figuring